You're listening to the Cannabis Investing Network. Before we begin, a short disclaimer. The full disclaimer follows at the end of this episode. This podcast is a general communication and is being provided for entertainment and information purposes only. It is educational in nature and is not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment strategy, plan, feature, or other purpose. Please enjoy responsibly.
Hello and welcome back to the Cannabis Investing Network podcast. My name is Manish and I am joined today by the master of the Momo himself. His name is Abby.
Yes, the Michelin star. Michelin star Manish. Well, actually, I wouldn't give you the Michelin star, but food critic Manish.
No, yeah, right. To give context to the people at home, Abby finally had me over to his new place. And he made us some handmade momos, which is like a Tibetan dumpling.
Nepali dumpling.
Sure. Nepali. Is it Tibetan or Nepali?
Nepali.
Okay, sure. So Abby's Nepali, in case you can't tell. So claiming ownership of the momo today.
Of course, yes.
But the momo wars. It was, you know, I got to say, it was good wine. It was good food. You know, the only negative was that I had to enjoy it with you. But
the company,
know.
Eh? Yeah. Oh man, that's too funny.
It was good though.
I'm glad you had a good time. I slaved all day in the kitchen for you. Went to the market, picked up fresh groceries.
Well, it was very much appreciated.
And for most people who actually don't know me, I rarely have food in the fridge, so it was a growing up moment.
I yeah, like it's that. Funny. After that, I went home and I shorted Uber Eats. Like, they're number one customers out of the game now.
I deleted the app. I actually deleted the app.
I predict a very bad Q1 for them. How's it going?
Very well. Very well. I can't. It's been a volatile week. It's been great. The weekend was fantastic. And all around, just good moods, man.
Good, 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 good. Well, today we're going to be talking about, I mean, this is actually a Q&A episode. So we haven't done one of these in a while, but we have a bunch of questions piled up that I thought
more
would be
Q's than
A's,
if anything.
Yeah, I mean, mostly just questions, right? I mean, the answers are, you know, nebulous.
Us pondering them as well.
Sure, yeah. It's the first time reading them, really. But yeah.
Exactly. It's like, hey, man, but, I have the same question.
But the theme you're going to hear about a lot today is this idea of cyclicality and the idea of the boom and the bust in human psyche, and a theme that we've talked about before, but it's just ringing so true to me right now, which is this idea of back to the future. And as a reminder, somebody I had a call with a while ago said, you know, cannabis in the US is really back to the future because, you know, when a new market opens up and it's very early stage, you know, it's almost predictable in that if you take a mature market like California and you go back 3 or 4 years, that's what the early stage markets kind of look like. And then they follow this predictable pattern of maturation, depending on the licensing structure and how many operators there are. And, you know, consumer tastes evolve and it starts out with just, you know, the very basic having flower and having distillate. And then it evolves and evolves and evolves until you have like people caring about, you know, terpene percentages and people caring about, you know, the highest quality flower, people wanting live resin cartridges and all these, you know, niche products. And to bring it to what we're talking about today, I'm seeing that in the markets and how people are behaving and all of the attitudes and, you know, the way people are talking about the market, it really feels to me, Abby, like we're back in 2019.
I mean, I agree with you. I would say we're back even further than that.
I mean, if we were talking about Bitcoin, then it feels more like 17 or 18.
Yeah, well, no, now it's called Dogecoin. That's the new one. That's the one that's going. Did you? Oh man, there's just. Anyways, let's not get into the crypto market. But no, 2019 was a weird year for both of us, I guess, because we were taking cannabis a lot more seriously. We were starting to put more money into it. The market completely tanked. Mm-hmm. No, it didn't. It had signs.
It started out strong. It started weak. Then it quickly recovered, and then Q1 into Q2 was really strong. If you actually rewind the clock, that's when Canopy bought Acreage, mm-hmm. or did the deal to agree to buy Acreage, and then everything was on fire. Like, it was just fuego for like 2 or 3 months, and then CanTrust scandal happened, and it was kind of just negative after negative, right? Like,
well, it was CanTrust was the straw, and then Bruce Linton leaving Canopy.
Well, it went CanTrust, then Bruce Linton got fired, then the vaping crisis, right? So like all, and these things happened over like 5 or 6 months or something, and it was just like negative after negative after negative, and a lot of the same things that people are negative about today. Like, again, I can't, it's funny how much history rhymes. Like, I remember in 2019 reading about the SAFE Act, right? Mm-hmm. Reading about the Moore Act, reading about the States Act, and like going through all these things and being like, oh my God, like uplisting and legalization and all these amazing things are coming. And then when they didn't go anywhere because they got stuck in the Senate, it went from like, you know, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity that you have to get into today, to suddenly it went to like, these stocks are worthless, get out now while you still can. Right?
And that's when the real once in a lifetime opportunity began.
That's an interesting point, right? And so this flip from euphoria to depression, we've seen this before. This is not unique. This is actually very common to human nature, and especially to retail investors. So that's really, just to start off today, what I want to talk about is how weirdly reminiscent this all is of 2019. And to give you a quick story, and Abby, I know you'll appreciate this. I went to the Benzinga conference, where actually you and I met in early 19, and Canopy buys Acreage, market's on fire. I went to California maybe a month later. And remember, it's California, the biggest cannabis market in the world, bigger than Canada. Win California, win the world. That was the saying. And, you know, I'm like just literally running, like going to a dispensary, asking them what is the best selling product? What are the coolest products? Okay. Then I'm going, you know, back to my hotel, emailing and calling all of these companies and saying, hey, can I meet with you? I'm in California. Okay. And at this time, everybody was knocking on their door. So most of the time you wouldn't even get, you know, a message back. When you did get a message back, because hey, they were raising money, most of the time I would get laughed out of the room because I wanted to write a check that was so small. They were like, yeah, maybe add 2 zeros and then we'll, you know, just talk about having a conversation with you.
Yeah. Yeah. And right? You're like, before the one or after the one?
Where do you want the zero?
Yeah, exactly.
After the decimal place, or
yeah, I'll add 4.
So, but you know, the funny thing is, you know, I remember leaving California very humbled, like very much like, oh, like I'm small potatoes, you know, whatever. All of those companies to a T did me a favor by not letting me invest, because I saw California go from like the sexiest story to like nobody wanted to touch it with a 10-foot pole. Mm-hmm. Right. And these companies like dropping, you know, like crazy. And, you know, funny story, one of the companies that, you know, actually has a great product got into trouble for also selling product on the black market. And, you know, this was a company that basically said to me on a call, if you can't write a $1 to $2 million check, don't bother talking to us.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, little did they know that check was for bail money.
Yeah, it's weird. They wanted it all in cash. I thought that was strange.
Yeah, it's like, hey, I need duffel bags. Bring it to this prison.
Unmarked bills. Yeah.
The call started off with an inmate at the LA Correctional Facility.
That's good. I like that. So all I'm saying is, it was interesting to see things go from like euphoric to suddenly like these companies are potentially worthless. Right. Like literally these companies are going, like people were saying these companies are going out of business. Some of them did, to now, you know, California is still not the sexiest story, but it's more of a middle ground. Mm-hmm. Right. And I saw, by the way, like these MSOs, this is not the first time we've had MSO mania. After the Acreage deal, people were obsessed with MSOs. That's all anybody wanted to buy.
Yeah, I agree. And I remember hearing about all those MSOs. And you know, that's when I was like, this makes zero sense, because back then, their strategies were land grabs.
Well, also depended, right? Because back then,
Well, MedMen was
MedMen. Yeah, MedMen was like the poster child, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so it was a different era, to your point. But all I'm saying is, it was interesting to see, like, okay, April, I'm in California. I'm, you know, meeting with all these companies. Nobody wants to talk to me. I'm trying to reach out to the MSOs. Literally no answer, right? The thing is, I didn't stop. Like, even when the market cooled, I kept going, right? We made this podcast. We dug in deeper. And here's the funny part about the market. It's like, people go crazy over it. Then they forget about it, right? They want nothing to do with it. But the companies are still there. So we went from like going to these conferences where the companies were rock stars to suddenly you could go to a conference and it was like easy to meet with, you know, any CEO you wanted.
That's very true. I remember, and I think that was the October Benzinga.
Oh my God. The October Benzinga was like, I think Charlie Bechtel was the keynote. And it was literally like you could do almost whatever you wanted at these conferences. Yeah. Like they were completely wide open to go talk to, you know, Kim Rivers or whoever, right?
Yep.
And you know, so that's living through the cycle was really, really interesting. And it was, you're kind of sitting there pulling your hair out being like, am I crazy or are these businesses where you want to be?
And those were, well, I mean, some of those businesses were where you wanted to be.
Right. Good point. Good right. point.
I mean, like there was just to sort of let people know that Benzinga, there was probably 10% were investors and 90% were companies. It's always not a good deal. That's always not like an ideal situation, right? When you see that many deals chasing that little capital.
Well, see, that's where I disagree with you.
Why? Well, I don't mean to say that these were really great companies that were just undercapitalized that needed capital allocation. These were like distressed assets that were on their last lifeline. And most of them were distressed for a reason.
Fair point. But when the air gets sucked out of the room, when there's not much capital there, mm-hmm. and the companies have to fight over the investors,
yep.
that's when you get the really, really juicy deals.
That is when you get the good deals. And that is what you, as an investor, that is ideally what you'd like to see. But you also have to be able to, you have to be good at identifying what those deals are. There's
yes.
a lot of turds out there and you got to find the polished turd, you know?
Oh boy. And to your point, you know, you have to have a strong stomach because the problem with investing at that time, you know, what we always talk about, it was like a falling knife, mm-hmm. right? Nobody knew and nobody ever knows where the bottom is.
Well, actually, if you recall that Benzinga, mm-hmm. there were more headwinds than tailwinds up and coming because we obviously couldn't foresee COVID happening. Mm-hmm. Canadian LPs were burning cash at insane levels. Cash balances were drying up.
Yep.
There weren't that many positive catalysts in the States coming up. Obviously, there was more safe and uplisting, but those did not seem imminent. Those seemed like years away. So there was still a lot more trouble to come. Mm-hmm. California was declining. Conquer Cali, conquer the world. Mm-hmm. That was declining. You had Florida that was starting to do well, but then you also had Kim, like the leader in Florida, Trulieve. You had Kim Rivers, her husband, was getting investigated by the DOJ. So there was even all the good deals had hair on them.
That's very true.
Right. So we got to remember that because I still remember to this day mm-hmm. at the end of the conference, there's always like a meet and mingle and you and I both just met up and we were both just exhausted because we had so many meetings and we were just like, man, like, are you writing any money? I'm like, no. I'm like, are you writing any money? It's like, no. It's like, wow, we just wasted like 3 days.
I think I did a couple of deals, but I hear you. We were pretty careful.
Yeah. Yeah. That was pretty
funny. And to your point, actually, that Benzinga was in Chicago and, you know, Illinois was going to turn legal in on Jan 1st, right?
Yeah.
And nobody could have known, or at least, you know, Illinois ended up being a much better market than almost anybody was predicting, right?
And yeah, what did they do? They did like 19 million in the first month.
No, they did way more than that. Yeah, way more than that. But the point being that, you know, like Illinois now is on a run rate of like one, and I think just based on last month, like almost 1.5 billion, maybe even higher than that. Sorry, it should be higher than that. But the key thing is,
I think it was 90 million in the first month, something like that.
Yeah,
I just remember an insane number.
I have to go back and check. It wasn't even, you know, the funny thing is it wasn't that the initial number was that crazy. It was just that it was just a start, right? Mm-hmm. First month seemed really good, but then it built over time. And more importantly, it was the limited license structure. There wasn't, you know, 1,000 companies splitting up the pie. It's 20 growers. And at the time, it was like 50 or 60 retailers,
mm-hmm.
right? So everybody was able to actually make really good money. That's the difference, right? And over time, over the year, we saw how much of a driver Illinois was,
yeah.
right? But to your point, Abby, you know, you could have invested in Jushi at that point at a really attractive, you know, structure. But, you know, who would have known that Illinois was going to be, you know, a savior for the company?
Right.
Right. Exactly. So you make a great point. Like, it's easy to look in the rear view and say, look at all these great deals. But the uncertainty level then was quite high. Whereas right. today, I think the uncertainty level is so much lower with these, you know, EBITDA cash flowing businesses who have proven themselves as operators. This is really, to me, a Goldilocks period where there's a pullback. We can invest at, in some cases, very attractive metrics, even on the big names. And yet, you know, we still have a lot of blue sky ahead of us. So that really excites me.
Yeah.
Last point on this is, and Abby, I want your opinion on this, is this idea, and again, I'm stealing this from Alan Brockstein, this idea of us being in this casino mentality, mm-hmm. where cannabis is one table in the casino. And, you know, people are looking around at other tables, right? There's psychedelic stocks, there's tech stocks, there's cryptocurrency. And it not to say that they're all the same to everybody, but people have their eye on a couple of different things.
Right.
And what happens is when one of the tables is not fun anymore, when it stops working, you're like, well, why am I playing this crappy game? Let me go to the winning table where everyone's having fun, mm-hmm. right? This weed stocks, these kind of suck. Let's go to the crypto, right? And if I put it another way, you know, kind of more friendly way, it's that if you're a momentum person, you want to keep your finger on the pulse of momentum. Well, the momentum doesn't seem to be here anymore, but there still seems to be plenty of heat somewhere else. So let me mm-hmm. go ride that wave of momentum and say goodbye to this one for a while.
Right.
And Abby, I want you to jump in here because we're seeing a resurgence right now in psychedelics, which is, you know, something that you have developed quite an expertise in.
Yeah, I wouldn't go as far as saying expertise, but I have invested a decent amount of time in psychedelics investing.
Okay.
Right.
That was great.
And going back to Alan Brockstein's quote on it being a casino table and being different tables or different sectors, I'll go one step further or one step more removed. Who knows? This metaphor is either going to hit or it's just going to go over everybody's head. Mm-hmm. But I would say picture all the games having very similar rules. But as soon as the momentum leaves, the next table, like whatever strategy you developed in this blackjack table will work on the poker table, right? Okay. It's like the same people that are showing up. And so what I mean by that is that all these, the three industries that you mentioned, I mean, I'm still going to say crypto is quite nascent, but psychedelics is a very nascent industry.
Sure.
Okay. And when you have an industry that's as early stage as psychedelics is, it's all event driven.
Sure.
Okay. And if you understand what events are going to drive returns, then you don't have to relearn the game. So you're sitting at another table where it's the same rules as last time. It's just the only thing different is the cards are different or the chips are different or whatever. The dice are different. I don't know. Right. So when you look at,
in the analogy you're using, it's like the rules of the game feel similar to something you already know.
Exactly. There you go. Very well put, eloquently put. And so if you know what the catalysts are and if you know how the sentiment will drive the market, then, you know, that's going to really determine where your next move is going to be because it's not driven by fundamentals, right? There are no fundamentals, right? When you're that early on. And so right now you mentioned that there was a resurgence in psychedelic stocks, and the resurgence was actually uplisting. Mm-hmm. MindMed uplisted to the NASDAQ, and that gave a lift to all psychedelic companies. And it's funny because cannabis, we always talk about uplisting, right? And psychedelics just got there first. And
yep.
that's sort of like why we see this re-rating. Now, I do believe in the psychedelic space. I do believe in especially with COVID and mental health issues being at the forefront. And I do think that there is an actual need to find alternative methods or alternative medicines for dealing with mental health. And psychedelics seems to be a great alternative, right? So people are accepting it. And they're taking more of a biopharma approach than sort of like rec and legalize, than a recreational play than the cannabis. So that's why I always feel it's unfair to draw parallels between the two.
Sure.
But what you can draw parallels on is forget about the underlying asset. Just look at where you are in the investment time horizon. So the parallels I would draw would be it's event driven, and these events have impactful outcomes. There's a positive sentiment with a lot of growth potential right now. So irrespective of whatever the numbers are, as long as these events continue to occur and sentiment continues to happen and momentum and volume are still there, you will get nice returns.
I mean, certainly have the possibility for it, right? I mean, yeah. It's to your point, it's not about the underlying business. It's about the, you know, sometimes the perception of the underlying business. And
exactly.
We talked about this before, you know, before we started, about this idea of like phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 trials. Mm-hmm. And I went this with, you know, a biotech name that I was playing around with. And it's like, you really learn like phase 1 and phase 2s don't really mean much. It's all really about that phase 3. That's where you prove efficacy.
Right.
And, you know, I don't think the average investor knows that, right?
But you're right. You're 100% you're right. An average investor wouldn't really know that. But what phase 1 and phase 2 do prove right now mm-hmm. is that they are legitimate businesses.
Yeah, maybe. Right? I mean, phase 1 and phase 2 proves that basically safety. Right?
Yeah, it means they filed the legal documents to actually go and pursue phase 1. Okay, great. Now it's not just some fly-by-night operation.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Right? As you continue to go down, knock these barriers down, it adds more and more legitimacy.
Like you are a real business. You're moving forward.
Exactly. And right. In early stages, you have to be, when you're investing in a sector that's this early, mm-hmm. you have to be very wary of that.
Fair. Yeah, fair. Totally. I mean, at the beginning, people are like, is this all a scam?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So just clearing those hurdles can be very, you know, can show people something, right?
Right, exactly. And it allows new entrants to come in and, you know, retail is typically what's driving this. But the funny thing is, like, there is actually more institutional money, I think, or more institutional players early at this early stage on psychedelics than there was in cannabis.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, to your point, like Compass uplisted, right? So, you know, that was showing that other people can do it, right?
Yep.
So I hear you. It's an interesting point. But so just to finish off this point before we go to the next one, what I got from this, again, this idea of Back to the Future is like, it's eerie how things kind of repeat themselves. And what it showed me is that retail investors, they make this classic mistake. And there's always kind of new money showing up willing to do this, which is that they hear about somebody making a lot of money quickly. Right. So in this case, that could be like Dogecoin, right? Mm-hmm. Or like MindMed in the last couple of days, right? They see these giant returns, they get excited, they pile into the market, and they'll buy whatever name at any price because it's going up. So it doesn't matter if you read the balance sheet, it doesn't matter if you know how to read a balance sheet or even you understand what the market cap is. You look at what's hot, you buy like something you feel is going to go up. And it doesn't matter the price you pay because it's going further up, right? And then when it goes down, inevitably, you know, this can't last forever. You can't keep having people come putting, you know, more and more money in. And eventually it comes to an end. And then when it crashes, they learn the wrong lesson, right? They get depressed. Mm-hmm. They walk away from it. And then, and by the way, this happened to me on Bitcoin. Where in late 17, I decided to put a little bit of money into Bitcoin and Ethereum. It did really, really well. I got super interested. And within like 2 or 3 months, I had completely forgotten about it and walked away.
Right.
Now, what happens is, now for me, it happened in reverse. I walked away from crypto and I committed myself to weed stocks. Right. Mm-hmm. But people are doing that in reverse now. They're saying, oh, forget cannabis. Let's go into crypto. But the mistake, I guess, that I'm getting to that really is the sad part is that people get excited for a short amount of time, then they, you know, cut it and then they move on and they don't retain the information. Mm-hmm. You know, if they stuck with it and kept learning over time, they probably would get good at investing.
Right.
Right. But because they keep following the cycle, they don't do it. So for me, that would be like if I came back now in 2021 and was like, oh, let me get back into crypto now. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, mm-hmm. I just wasted 3 years that I could have been getting all this deep expertise and actually developed an edge.
Right. And meeting the key players and having information. That
exactly.
That, yeah, exactly. You can exactly. You get from just reading a balance sheet. But yeah, you're right.
Exactly. So that to me is the real negative. And I think that cycle will always repeat itself because
it definitely will.
People always want to get rich. That's never exactly. going to change.
And one thing that a lot of people I find is they, and sometimes we do this as well, mm-hmm. we stroke with a broad brush the term retail. You have to understand that retail is all, it's like there's always new people that are entering, right? So it's not really retail investors, it's novice investors that make this mistake, because there are sophisticated retail investors who avoid all these bubbles, people like yourself who have stayed in cannabis forever, right? Since day one. You said, okay, this is going to be my niche. I'm going to stay in this lane, right? You dabbled here and there, but like your main focus has been here. You are still a retail investor. Are you a novice investor? I mean, I wouldn't classify you as a novice investor, but mm-hmm. I feel that retail and novice sort of go hand in hand, and that's not necessarily fair.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah, good point. This goes back to an episode we did a little while ago, not that long ago, about retail and avoiding retail mistakes. Mm-hmm. Retail is very broad. It includes a lot of different people, but you don't want to make the retail mistakes.
No, but unfortunately, if you're like, I don't know, let's say we've got a listener here who's like in their early 20s and, you know, they just graduated university and they've got some money and they're trying to invest. They're going to make mistakes. You will make mistakes, and you will learn from, as long as you learn from those mistakes and don't make them over again and don't get discouraged, right? Like, you know, you and I, we always come out here and we talk about our losses too. And so it's, you know, you've got to stay there and you've got to learn from your losses and you got to continue.
And the more painful they are, the more you don't want to talk about them, the more important they are. That's
just bury them deep.
Deep. Yeah. Then you have to pay for therapy to uncover them. It's a whole thing.
Yeah. Well, when you have enough capital losses, you know, you don't pay taxes. So
last point on this before we go on. I lost it now.
The point?
Yeah, I was gonna say something, but I forgot. Oh well, it's great. Let's keep rolling. So mm-hmm. On to one more point, then we'll get to the Q&A. Legalization. So, you know, people seem to have come to the realization that, oh, legalization is not happening tomorrow. And, you know, this to me is good. Like, ultimately, people were getting way too excited about, you know, they were pricing in things that were uncertain. I remember when Schumer was talking about dropping the bill, somebody was like, oh, this is going to happen. This is like a done deal. And I was like, whoa, like done deal. Like,
yeah,
this is a big piece of legislation. It's going to have a lot of horse trading. We don't even know what's in the bill yet. Right. Like I'll be happy if we get the Safe Banking Act, you know, federal legalization is a giant issue, giant can of worms to kind of unravel.
For sure.
And my interpretation of this, and I don't have a competitive advantage, but you know, I have some level of insight into this, is that looking at it rationally, I think Schumer realizes that he has the votes to pass SAFE. Okay, SAFE is basically a bipartisan bill. But he doesn't want to do this. He wants to go bigger. And he has put his name and his stamp on this legalization bill. He keeps coming out and talking about it. And people are getting mad because they're like, why hasn't it dropped yet? Guys, this is politics. Nothing gets written in a week or a month, right? Like, it takes months to write this stuff. And right. if you look at like SAFE and states and more, these bills have been around for years and they're getting passed again and again and again, right?
And different iterations, there's a lot of compromises. They get as they go through, the bill changes drastically from what it started to what it finishes at.
It gets tweaked, et cetera, et cetera. Great mm-hmm. point. So people are realizing like, oh my God, like Joe Biden's not going to keep his campaign promise on cannabis. It was never his promise. Like, go back and look at it. He's never talked. You can literally listen to our election episode from last year. He has never mentioned weed one time except negatively. And then he was like, back when he was like still running for the nomination, like he like spoke negatively about it. They took him to the back room, sat him down, explained to him that he's not allowed to have this position. And then he came out and said, oh yeah, yeah. Okay. I get it now. Like, it's never been a position of his. I think for him, he would love it if nobody ever mentioned cannabis again.
Right.
Right. But Schumer is putting a stake in the ground. He is the best ally we have. I think the fact that he wants to go big is actually good. Like, let him fight. Let him bring out this big bill. How it's looking right now, he's going to get pushback. He's going to have to horse trade. He's going to have to compromise. And probably at the end of the day, I think the fallback is going to be go back to safe, beef up safe, right? And maybe pass a compromise safe or maybe pass a watered down legalization bill, right? It's going to be very hard to pass a really, really big bill, but he's going to want to get something done and he's going to want to put his mark on it, not just have it be somebody else's bill.
For sure, for sure. And I agree with you. And I think with him, I think he will overreach in the beginning. And then they're going to come back just like any other negotiation. You're going to ask for a lot more, then the other party's going to come back, cut it down. And then, you know, we will, I don't know if it'll be a watered down version, but hopefully we get something half decent out of it.
I mean, look, at the end of the day, getting safe, like safe itself isn't that amazing, right? It's just banking, right? Which people forget, like there is banking at the state level anyway. Mm-hmm. Like in California, you can use a California credit union. Right. And you can even use some of these banks across state lines. So it's not like the greatest thing in the world. It definitely would be good. And the key thing is, if they end up beefing up safe, I think you'll get uplisting. Because ultimately, if you want to make a big change in America and, you know, you can't get legalization passed, the next best thing is to get these companies on the big boards. Mm-hmm. Because once they're on CNBC and they're on the NASDAQ, right? And institutions are investing in them, then legalization will be inevitable.
For sure. And with both of these like acts, not including full legalization, but with the Safe Banking Act, uplisting has always been the main prize. Even though Safe allows you to get more access to sort of debt capital, you can use banking, et cetera. The main re-rating is going to be from uplisting. And why? It's because A, you're going to have a broader investor base. B, these big board exchanges add credibility across the globe, not just in the States. But you have to remember there's European mandates out there that can only invest in certain companies.
Certain exchanges.
Mm-hmm. And people always ask, well, like, why is that? And it's, imagine if you were investing in a German company, for example, right? You know, Germany's got the Frankfurt Exchange. Or you know what? Let's use the UK as an example, because this example happens a lot more. So let's say you're investing in the UK and you don't live in the UK, right? You've got the AIM and then you've got the London Stock Exchange. Okay, so you've got two different exchanges that you can choose from.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is a big board exchange, which ultimately you already know has more regulations and rules in place, which means the level of due diligence that's been done is a lot more stricter. The criteria to get listed is a lot more stricter. So already there, you've got a perceived notion of safety. And usually when people are writing out investment policy statements, they want to mitigate risk. So they put this criteria in, which now means that your broader investor base is not only larger, they're more credible and they write bigger checks and they're fully across the globe, right? So, and then the last thing is it's going to open... uplisting is going to open up to institutional mandates and institutional investors. And that's just more capital flowing in. So ultimately more eyeballs, more capital, strict regulations, which is great for the sector.
Yeah. Look, no disrespect. The OTC is a garbage exchange. Okay. So like, there's no other way to say that. And by the way, I had a bunch of US dollars, so I've been buying some of my stocks on the OTC instead of the CSE. It, absolutely wild. The games that are played on the OTC. Like, you know, there's an ask there and you're like, okay, cool. There's this many shares at this price. You put in the bid, you fill like 10% of it and then it moves immediately. And you're like, oh, that's kind of funny.
How's that possible?
Because the market maker is playing games, right? They're like, they put the bid out there, they front run your order and then they move it. And that doesn't happen on every stock. I'm just saying like, it's glaringly obvious on the OTC.
Oh, really?
Right? And what somebody explained to me is like, yeah, that market maker, like who is a market maker for the OTC in the US, right? It's like some backwater brokerage that like nobody wants to work with, right? They have to make money on every trade. Mm-hmm. So like, it's the Wild West, literally. Like it's hard for us to understand because we're so early how far off things are. Mm-hmm. We did an episode a while ago called The Golden Age of Investing in US Cannabis. I just want to say to you guys, like the fact that the valuations have essentially reset back to where they were in December, that is a good thing. There is nothing bad about that in my books, unless you're fully invested. And in which case, like, hey, like this is a lesson to always give yourself some wiggle room. Mm-hmm. But to me, I'm pouring more money in because the fundamentals are advancing and yet the valuations are retreating. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, let's get into the questions. Mike B from Boston. He, and Mike B, by the way, longtime listener, sends in some great articles. So shout out to Mike B. We usually in the past have said a lot of bad things about the ETFs in the space, but what about MSOS? He was asking, like, why is it that they can hold OTC cannabis stocks, but they're on the big board? And what do we think about it? And do we recommend it? Mm-hmm. Abby, do you want to take this one?
I don't think we've really said that many bad things about ETFs in general. It's more just that MSOS doesn't have a competitive advantage that you don't have right now.
Well, sorry to cut you off there. In the past, because Mike B is an old school listener, we have said terrible things about ETFs in the cannabis space. But that's because...
Oh, because of HMMJ and...
Or no, just right. Because of the way the regulation worked, they could only hold Canadian stocks.
Right, right.
They couldn't... So MSOS is actually really clever in that they figured out a way to hold these OTC cannabis stocks. And the way they do it is a swap. So they don't actually hold it. They have a contract with a market maker who holds it for them.
Right, right.
So there's that's groundbreaking. We've never
seen that groundbreaking, but there's also a risk associated with it, which means that MSOS does not own the underlying asset.
Yeah, there's a little bit of swap risk, and we don't understand the complexity of that, and some weird things happen. Like you'll see,
I don't think it'll ever get to a point where, you know, if the company defaults or if it gets to like that point where they need to own the underlying asset. I don't think so, but you've got to be very cognizant of that risk going into it. And you know, it was amazing for the sector, right? When MSOS came, you remember the volume spikes that we saw on the large
totally.
And have it, right?
Totally.
And actually, one of our listeners, I'm not going to say his name, but he knows who he is because I met him in Vegas. And him and I have been chatting. He has a really great strategy. So what he does is he watches the MSOS's top 10 holdings, and he tries to replicate it to the best of his abilities. Right? There are certain names that he doesn't like, but if MSOS starts adding to it, he starts adding to it. If it starts trimming, he starts trimming.
Nice.
So he's getting... I'm going to say indirect exposure, but he's getting direct exposure to MSOS by owning the underlying assets, by just watching the top 10, right? Now, if Mike, if you have enough time to do that, this is a great strategy, but it's time consuming, right? And if you want to just be a little bit more passive, then, you know, MSOS is not a really, it's not the worst way to play the space.
I think it's great. Like, I actually think it's like, to your point, you're probably going to do better if you actually just go buy the underlying securities, because you're not going to have this, you know, they have to pay a swap cost and all this stuff. And they do kind of weird things, like, because of these swaps, like, you'll see, like, the volume spike right at the end of the day in a name. And it's like a giant, you know, it shoots it up at the end of the day, and then next day it kind of collapses again, and you'll see it's because MSOS was buying. So there seems to be some weird things going on because of that. But, you know, the strategy Abby just outlined, that's a great way to have most of the exposure without any of the headaches.
Right.
But, you know, basically if somebody was new to the space or doesn't want to invest that much time, I would actually say it's a good way to get exposure without doing the work.
Yeah, it's a great way to do it. And keep in mind, I know Manish, you did talk about those fees. Those fees are already embedded in the price that you pay. So you're not paying the fee in addition to those, to whatever the price of MSOS is at the time.
Right. You're saying it's the ETF pays it. It's not like you're paying it out of pocket.
Yeah. So let's say the one unit of the ETF is $10, right? You're only paying $10. All the fees, like the price that you get is net of fees.
Well, yeah, but ultimately the money goes somewhere, right? Like you're buying into the fund has to pay.
Yeah, yes, for sure. But like a lot of people, like for example, if you were to buy a stock, right, and you pay $50 to buy a stock, then you're paying a commission on top of that. So it's like $50.01 or whatever the commission that you're paying on top of it is, right? Again, this you have to check with your own trading account, but in Questrade, they don't charge you for buying ETFs.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, right, if you look at MSOS, it says it has like, I don't know what the actual... MER is the management expense ratio, but it's going to have one. It's probably going to be like 10 to 15 basis points. That management expense ratio is built into the price.
Right. It comes, basically they take it out of the holdings, right?
Yeah.
But I think it's probably much higher than that given the specialty of the,
probably,
of the fund.
Yeah.
But anyway, another thing is Tim Seymour, who runs CNBS, which is another kind of big board listed one. They just got ability to do what MSOS is doing. So I think we all really owe MSOS, like, you know, kind of a debt of gratitude, because they were the first ones to figure this out, and they're trailblazers. And that's a lot of the boom you were seeing. You know, when people were jumping in February, they were buying MSOS, and MSOS was pushing up the prices of the securities, right? Yeah. And some of the, when it retreated, I think they were unwinding some securities, not a lot, but some securities. And that can have a painful effect too, right? So hopefully that covers MSOS. Next question is from Ryan P. And Ryan is a new retail investor. He started investing in cannabis in January of 2021. And basically he's afraid that the upcoming federal legalization changes would make cannabis regulated similar to alcohol, which would be very negative. And he sent me a thread on Reddit, which I will post in the show notes, that was actually really insightful. And it has like one legal expert and one alcohol expert discussing the fact that, you know, this is how alcohol is regulated, and that Senator Wyden, who's working on the bill with Senator Booker and Senator Schumer, Senator Wyden has written a bill before, which, you know, does all these things that regulates marijuana or cannabis like alcohol. Right. Mm-hmm. And some things are, you know, basically like alcohol is not allowed to be vertically integrated. You can't own a bar and, you know, be a large scale producer of alcohol. Also, like the taxation for like tobacco is very different and, you know, would cause a lot of issues for the vertical operator. So it's very complex. I don't want to tell you that I understand all of this, but it was really interesting to read. And basically Ryan's point here is that he's afraid to invest before he has clarity on this. And he's kind of surprised that, you know, this kind of stuff is not discussed more by, you know, the MSO gang and all these people who are so bullish.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know why. I mean, Ryan, I don't know how long you've been in the industry for, but I don't think anybody in the MSO gang would talk about this like openly.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's two things, right? I think one, and this is a big negative, is that there's a big echo chamber. And that's like, if I have a knock against this whole MSO gang idea, it's that people are just sharing, you know, really bullish news with each other to get each other riled up. And then that's why, you know, it's kind of funny when the tide goes in and, you know, it's not as hot anymore, where is the MSO gang at? Right. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you kind of see them kind of retreat. Right. But like, you know, these are really interesting points, right? Like, and my point would be, let's see what the bill says. Right. Like, we really don't know what's going to be in that bill. And then on top of that, we don't know if that bill is actually going to get passed. Right.
For sure. For sure. And I mean, look, and the other thing to really hammer home on this is that it's still a positive. If this bill kind of comes out and it says, hey, we're going to start regulating it like alcohol or tobacco or whatever, that's still a positive in the sense of from where we are right now. We're getting one step closer to legalization. So those. Mm-hmm. Like, I think the positive sentiment from what, like, that event would come out, yeah, it'd be a negative for a little while, but once that gets hashed out, you will still see the stocks rise, right? And I don't think...
Oh, I think they would fly.
Yeah, so Ryan, to your question on that, why you're surprised that people aren't, why this isn't discussed more before people are investing, I think if you were to invest now, and again, listen, I'm not saying you should invest now, you should always, you know, consider your own financial risk. But for example, if you were to, hypothetically speaking, if you were looking at it and you invest now and this Wyden bill passes, I think the stocks will get re-rated in a positive way.
Yeah, and that's a great point. And like, so Ryan, if you think about what you're concerned about, this is kind of the funny thing, right? There's like two sides of the spectrum. So right now people are depressed, like we're never going to get legalization, we're never going to get uplisting, right? Your concern is on the other end of the spectrum. It's what I like to call like being cannabis being super legal, right? Where suddenly you can like, you have interstate commerce and you can sell it in CVS and right. So like, you know, these are the two polarities, right? And both of them are not good, right? But you know, to Abby's point, the polarity of super legality, if that was to happen, I mean, you also with that, you're getting uplisting, you're getting, you know, the entry of large tobacco and alcohol into the space. You're getting all these good things.
The largest company won't be like Curaleaf anymore, you know, like it won't be a $6 billion value. Sorry, it won't be like a $6 billion valuation. It'll go way higher than that.
Well, more likely, like people will come and invest in the biggest companies, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
So that's a really interesting thought. Definitely something to think about. No question. But, you know, a super legal system, I think you have a lot of time between now and then. Like, you'll get a lot of benefit before you get the negative, I think.
Right. And Ryan, like, you know, if you want to see a super legal system, look at Canada. And to be honest, I think alcohol is a better legislative framework than tobacco is for cannabis.
Yeah, probably true.
And in Canada, we basically, they took the Tobacco Act, hit control F, typed in tobacco, and then put in cannabis.
Mm-hmm. That's just replaced tobacco originally. With cannabis, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay. Oh, by the way, the current political gridlock, the way this is working, super legal system doesn't seem likely. Status quo seems more likely. And my point is, I mean, other than the fact that people are getting locked up every day for cannabis, which is insane, like status quo from a business perspective, not that bad for existing operators. They're doing pretty well.
And I do want to add one thing, irrespective of whichever route this goes, one thing that I can say with a lot of conviction is cannabis is going to be heavily regulated and heavily taxed. So just know that.
For right? sure.
Like, it doesn't matter how bad it is. Like, just know it's going to be taxed more than probably any other industry you're going to see.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no question. Okay, so next question is from CJ. So CJ has been investing since 2017. And back then, he bought the big MSOs, the small MSOs, the LPs. He bought everything. And, you know, to him, there was kind of no difference back then. So CJ, I've been there. So I hear you. Learned a lot from the ups and downs, bought, sold, etc. He points out that, hey, by the way, you guys always say read the financial statements, but, you know, it's not as easy as it seems, especially finding the outstanding share count is kind of harder than it seems. So CJ, fair point. If you're reading financials and you're having a hard time, it means you're doing it properly, right? That means you're reading something you don't understand. And like, you know, that's how you learn, right? So, and from his email, it does sound like he is learning and that's great, but you know, it's not something you're going to learn overnight, but you want to keep trying. Right now, on the outstanding share count part, what I would suggest to you is two things. On the financial statements, search like control F shares or outstanding, and you'll usually find a line item that shows you something. On the better document actually is the MDA, the Management Discussion Analysis, which gets posted alongside the financials in Canada, at least on SEDAR. And the MDA, if you search outstanding or shares, you'll usually find it. And I have an example actually later on that I did this.
Yeah, and with share counts, CJ, like this is, I believe, done intentionally. Even those share counts that you do find in the MDA, it's mm-hmm. not 100% accurate. And I've noticed that tons of times. And the reason, and I've seen discrepancies from different trading platforms to different like information in terms of what market caps are based off of shares outstanding. And that's because some of them will include management options. Some of them won't include management options. If there was an M&A that was done, if there was an acquisition that was done, you now have to take those shares into consideration. So there's a lot of moving parts. And the thing with financial statements is that they're always backwards, right? They're always 3 months behind. Mm-hmm. Maybe not 3 months behind, but like, they're usually 3 months behind, right? Like they're usually one quarter behind. And so if there's been anything that's been done, that's not going to be reflective of the market, but you don't need to know the exact number, but as long as you have a gauge, right? Because once you have a gauge of one, then you sort of, you can use that as a gauge. And from a relative perspective, that's where you can sort of see what the company's worth. But CJ, you're on the right track. And I still have trouble finding out fully diluted share counts.
Everybody,
outstandings.
Yeah, it's a great point. Everybody does, right? I mean, we talked about Verano the other week and how like Verano is not, you know, making it easy to know what their share count is, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, to your point, Abby, it's not about necessarily finding the share count exactly to the share. It's about the fact that sometimes you think the share count is, you know, 170. You know, we're gonna talk about TerraSend in a bit. You think the share count's 170 and it's actually 300.
Yeah.
So you're like, why is everyone saying it's so expensive? And then it's because you think it's only, I mean, think about that for a second. That's like saying, imagine somebody came to you and said, oh my God, Abby, I bought this stock. It's $10 a share. And you're like, what do you mean? You actually paid $18 a share.
Right.
People would think that was outrageous. They would think that was like unbelievable. And yet that's the same thing you're doing with those share counts.
For sure. For sure. Right. And a great, and Manish, you're good at doing this to sort of keep track of that. You've got to have good records because when these press releases come out, they will put how many shares were given. They will sometimes put like hint at share counts. And if you can add them to your spreadsheet, and then when you go back and reconcile when the financials come out, that's a good way to sort of see where you're going wrong or even get shares that may have not shown up on the MD&A.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the MDA to me seems to be the most updated, and they seem to even sometimes update it as of the date of publishing. So that's definitely the place to look. But I agree. If you want to get more advanced, you keep your own records. But to keep going on this one, so CJ talks about the fact that he's invested in the big MSOs, but he's asking, what do you think about speculative penny stocks? And he's basically saying, look, like these can sometimes be as good or even better opportunity than the small MSOs.
Speculative penny stocks. Oh,
I know. Pennies. If you say that three times fast and click your heels, Abby will appear in front of you.
Hello, CJ. No,
a little tickle in my throat there. So sorry, just to finish it. Look, CJ, you're speaking my language, right? I think it's well documented. I like to play in the mud. And my favorite thing is to find like a company in cannabis that I think is a very real company and has good value and has good upside that other people either misunderstand or think is kind of crappy or think is a scam, right? I mean, and you know, what CJ's strategy is to just invest like a small amount of money in these and just keep track of them and see how they do. And I actually really like this strategy because I find personally, I only learn when I have money on the line.
For sure, so yeah.
Even if it's a small amount of money, you're going to pay a lot more attention to it.
Absolutely. And I'm not sure, CJ, if you were specifically referring to cannabis speculative penny stocks, but I love rolling the pennies as well. And there is opportunity to have massive upside. And I always say this about pennies. There's a high degree of certainty that, a penny can, like penny stocks can double or triple, right? There is possibility that can happen. There's an even higher degree of certainty that it can go to zero. So just know that when these stocks are running and you don't know why they're running or you just bought it because it was a ticker, you should always sell when you see volume increasing and like stocks starting to spike. And one other thing that I would always say when you're investing in penny stocks is if you can go through press releases and find out when large unlocks are going to happen, that's a good way to sort of avoid some landmines.
Yeah, good point. But I just want to point out, Abby, something that you've actually said on other episodes, which is that it's really important to differentiate from, a typical speculative penny stock, right? Like something to your point earlier might be, there's no business there, but it's all hype driven versus like some of these cannabis companies, a lot of them have real businesses and like are good businesses, but they're just the shares trade under a dollar, right? Like, so Abby, if you look at our notes on CJ is the one who gave that big list of names, right? Almost every one of those names he provided is a real business, right? Like has real fundamental underlying business. I'm not saying they're all great, but very different from investing in like a purely speculative name where like, they have no revenue.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm saying like different game, right? Like it's just because it's a penny stock or just because it's under a dollar doesn't mean that it's, like purely speculative, right? If they have a good underlying business. I mean, as an example, CJ, like some of the, quote unquote penny stocks, meaning like under a dollar that have treated me really well are like literally Liberty Health, Bluma and Cansortium. And I mean, it's not just the outcome. Like these are companies that were, Cansortium and Liberty, like doing over $50 million of sales in a year, mm-hmm. right? Like it's very atypical for that to be a quote unquote penny stock.
For sure. And I'm going to take the other stance, Manish. Just because it's a penny stock does not mean it's cheaply valued. You have to look at
100%,
right? You can have you can have stocks that trade at 10 cents, but they could have a billion shares outstanding. Yep. That is not a small cap stock.
Great point.
Right. Great so point. Keep that in mind as well. So, So just very, very, just really know that.
Yeah. Great point. So he actually listed out. I'm sorry. Last point here. He says, it's really hard to find good information on Canada because, people, for example, like us kind of ignore it now. And, CJ, you might be onto something there. I personally like this idea of trying to turn over rocks where people aren't looking and developing a niche there. Right. And you can do really well. And that's what I did in Florida. Right. There was great access to information. I didn't make the money I should have made on Trulieve. That's my fault, but I did get to make a lot of money on Bluma, Liberty and Cansortium, right? Mm-hmm. So, I was looking at a place where other people weren't really that interested.
Well, Florida, everybody was interested in Florida.
Well, not really though.
That was the poster child.
Yeah, but again, it's easy to say that now after all these acquisitions, right? But 4 or 5 months ago, you could have bought Bluma for like really cheap. You could have bought Liberty. Like all of these names were out there, right? Mm-hmm. But everybody was just like, ah, they're out there. Who cares?
Right.
Right.
Well, but because I guess people discounted it. They were saying that, oh, well, Trulieve has dominated Florida. Mm-hmm. Who cares about these other guys?
Right. But I mean, again, that, and people didn't even care about Trulieve that much until they did. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's anyway, all I'm saying is, CJ, the one thing I'll tell you on Canada, though, that you got to be careful of is, you know, when you look at the big board names in Canada, they're still too expensive, in my opinion. Right. Like the guys like, you know, Aphria and Tilray, you know, that kind of shows you Canada has caught a wave again and they have been bid up again and they still might not be as cheap as you think. Right. So that's just a caveat there. Mm-hmm. And it's a tough business in Canada. But what I would say just briefly on these kind of small cap names, it's first of all, I like to go for names that are profitable or close to profitability because otherwise you're going to have to keep raising. And with these smaller names, raising can be really ugly, right? You can be talking full warrant coverage or just like just really diluted financing, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, it hurts if you're just buying, you know, the common stock on the OTC or whatever, right? But the second thing is, you know, you want something that's important. So I know a lot of, you know, on his list here, C21, a lot of people have looked at C21 because, you know, they have cash flow. But ultimately, you know, I've looked at C21. It's fine, but it doesn't necessarily look to me like something somebody needs to buy.
Yeah.
Right? Like Florida, people need to be in Florida. Cresco had to be in Florida, right? Most guys are already in Nevada. They don't need to buy C21 to get into Nevada. You could still buy some private operators there maybe. So
I was going to say, that's actually a very interesting outlook because now you're looking at it not from an investor perspective, but you're looking at it from like a company perspective. If a company wants exposure to a certain state, mm-hmm. then you know, you're essentially looking for acquisition targets.
Well, that's part of the puzzle, right? That's why Florida was so attractive is because it's like, hey, A, these companies are profitable. They're mm-hmm. putting up good margins. And then like Florida is such a key state in the US, right? Like these companies have to be there, right? So that's why, you know, so he has a list here that we'll just touch on briefly because we got to keep rolling. But, you know, Cansortium is on his list. You know, I can't even remember how many times I've talked about Cansortium now and people thought I was crazy. You know, I bought it at 40 cents. It's like $1.20 now and I'm selling. Mm-hmm. By the way, it's $1.20 because SOL Global and Andy D are buying it. He announced that on his Twitter, by the way. It's not special information. Nice. But again, like Cansortium is a bit of a mess of a company, but it's got 24, 25 stores in Florida.
Right.
So that's a very important retail footprint, right? And in a key state. And you got to look at it and say, wouldn't TerrAscend like that? Wouldn't Jushi like that? You know, there's so many things you can kind of put in there. And their Texas license you're getting kind of for free. So like, that's something that is that, you know, other people are going to show up and see value in.
Yeah.
Right. So whereas, you know, if you pick a name like, you know, also on his list, like, I don't know, I'm trying to look here, like Tilt, for example, I don't know Tilt very well, but, you know, Tilt seems to have operations and kind of a hodgepodge of operations that other people might already have.
Right.
So even if there's good value, even if they're making money, which again, I don't know this name very well, the question is, does it matter? How important is it? Right. And there might be nothing wrong with that investment, but ultimately, we all have limited dollars here, and we need to be very careful about how we allocate those dollars. We want to put them kind of in the best possible place.
For sure, and I'm looking through CJ's list over here as well. I know he talked about Canada. There's two names that really stick out for me here on this list, CJ, that if I wanted exposure to Canada, I would go with, and that's High Tide and Innerspirit. Mm-hmm. Reason why is I think if you want access in Canada, dispensaries are sort of the only real way. Which is very different than my tune back in 2019. And, you know, High Tide is opening dispensaries like crazy. Innerspirit is one that it's like a brand off Spirit Leaf. Spirit Leaf is their dispensary. I would say those are the two best ways to get exposure in Canada from your list. It's just the part of the value chain that I like. And if you want to sort of not de-risk, but if you want to reallocate some capital out of the U.S., those would be the two that I would really look at closer to.
Interesting. And the three I highlighted on his list are Cansortium, Lowell Farms, which is single state producer in California, good brand, good product, and they're going really big. So that one day could be an interstate commerce play. And the third is Next Green Wave. And I actually know Mike Jennings, the CEO, pretty well. Great guy. You know, they've got the company itself has a little bit of a promotional IR messy history, which is not great. But they actually taught me a lot about, you know, high quality indoor grown flower and doing crazy EBITDA margins. You know, so if you go through my list now, it's valued attractively, doing great margins. But then there's that piece of, okay, you know, how much do you matter, right? And, you know, ultimately people will show up to California and I think they'd be a good acquisition target. But, you know, do you rush to buy them today? That's kind of the tricky part with that name, right?
Right.
So that just kind of gives you an idea, like much better company, in my opinion, than Cansortium. And yet Cansortium seems a lot more valuable to me, right? Just from its collection of licenses.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of different ways of thinking about it. And then you have to, you know, adjust accordingly.
Right.
Okay. Last point. He asked about TerrAscend and he asked about AYR. So, you know, I've said in the past, TerrAscend's way overvalued. He said, okay, well, what is the price where you like it? And I was like, you know, I don't even know. Like, I went on Yahoo Finance and it said the market cap was, in US was $1.75 billion. And that's roughly $10 US a share. And I thought, hey, that's actually better than I thought. And so that implies 170 million shares roughly, right? So I was feeling lazy, but then I thought, you know what? You know, CJ literally just told me that finding outstanding shares is hard. So let me go do the work. I type in on Google, TerrAscend CDAR. I pull up their CDAR. I pull up their MDA. So management discussion analysis, and literally CJ, I just control F and I put in outstanding. Okay. And on page 28 out of 59, so everybody can do this. You can go on CDAR, TerrAscend, MDA for 2020. And on page 28 of 59, at the top of the page, there's a very nice table outlining all of the fully diluted shares. And, you know, guess what? The real share count's not 170 million. It's 313 million.
Well, that's a fully diluted share count though, right?
Yes. But you know what it includes? It includes a lot of the multiple voting shares,
mm-hmm.
which are just regular shares. They're just a different class of shares.
Yeah.
Right? They're just what they use to control the company. It includes all the warrants and options, which by the way, are way in the money. Way in the money.
Okay.
So, you know, like, what's the difference? Like, this is the real share count.
I guess so. Yeah, that's true.
Right? I mean, so you have over 300 million shares at $10 USD. It's a $3 billion company, and yet people on Yahoo Finance think it's 1.75.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You're almost double the valuation that people think it is. That's part of the problem here. And, you know, like, look, share structures are complicated, so I'm not knocking anybody, mm-hmm. but I have to think some of these companies know this. And they're
for sure.
And they're deliberately, you know, doing it so that Yahoo Finance shows one number where then, you know, the real number is completely different.
Yeah.
So, you know, on the surface, I was like, oh, TerrAscend, 175, not bad. It's actually 3 billion. And I'm like, okay, this is exactly what I'm talking about. It has right. a huge premium on it because of Canopy Growth and the relationship they have there. And, you know, Canopy's probably going to buy TerrAscend, right? Something's cooking with TerrAscend. That's why the CEO got fired. My speculation. But AYR is a way better company, in my opinion. Proven themselves in two states, expanded to, I think, what, seven states now. They bought Liberty Health in Florida. They're going to New Jersey. They're going to be a real player in Pennsylvania. They're in Arizona, and they have a grow license in Ohio now. So lots of scaling and work ahead of them,
mm-hmm.
but they have the footprint, and they're trading at, you know, much lower valuation than TerrAscend. You know, TerrAscend theoretically still has to go dilute itself if they want to go do all these acquisitions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how do you get into Florida? Like, I mean, you have to go buy Cansortium or you have to buy Vidacan. There's not a lot of options here.
And actually here, while you were chatting, I use a program called Stockwatch for live quotes, and it's a mm-hmm. service that I pay for. I just pulled up TerrAscend and pulled up their fundamentals. Their share count, their shares issued to this day, or as of close Monday, April 26th, is 77 million. They're showing a market cap of 977 million.
TerrAscend.
Isn't that insane? Yeah, TerrAscend.
So even the service you pay for has the wrong numbers.
For sure. And so this is, but I know this. I know this like going in. So I don't use Stockwatch for shares issued. I only use it for live quotes. They're really good at giving you like live quotes, basically live prices.
Right.
But CJ, to your point, it is extremely difficult to find out what the actual share count is.
Yes, but again, I'm not kidding. I literally found it in 3 minutes. Now, I know where to look, okay? But again, I would just challenge everybody to do exactly what I just told you. TerraSend, CDAR, go to the MDA, Control F, outstanding. It was like the fifth one, like the fifth result was mm-hmm. literally a beautiful table. Like, it literally can take you 10 minutes to find, and it can save you a whole lot of heartache.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. You can't afford not to do it, in my opinion. But
no, you're right. You're 100% right. But a lot of people will just go and rely. Like, this is a paid-for service. Yeah, right?
Most people look at Yahoo Finance, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's it, right? So anyway, let's keep on rolling because we're over an hour now. So we've got a couple questions we're going to close it out with. So Max from Berlin. Berlin Max, I've been calling him. Max has been a listener since the early days, and he loves our dad jokes. I think he was referring to you there, Abby.
Max, you and I have the same sense of humor.
Okay, do you want to go for these questions?
Yeah, so he's talking about Canadian float of MSOS.
MSOs.
Oh, MSOs. Okay.
So this question is basically just, you know, if the MSOs uplist, will they still keep their CSE listing? Because he wants to rather own it in Canadian dollars versus US dollars.
He wants to like play like an ARB.
No, he's like, for whatever reason, he likes Canadian dollars. So like when GTI goes to the NASDAQ, will they still stay on the CSE?
Probably not.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I really have no idea. You know, that being said, like a lot of the investors are still on the CSE. So I don't think they would delist until they're really, really comfortable that it's not going to be a negative for them.
Yeah. I mean, like if they can uplist because the next uplisting is a TSX. The TSX is a big board exchange, but it doesn't provide the same clout that NASDAQ provides, right? So there isn't that much of an incentive to do.
Yeah, I don't, again, no clue.
Yeah, this is just something that where it's just spitballing here.
Yeah, I mean, if I, like, do they want to be on the CSE? No, they hate the CSE. Let's keep it real. But it's better than the OTC, one. And, you know, you don't want to hurt your stock, right? So I imagine they stay there for a while, but at some point in this super legal future, I imagine it goes away.
For sure. And actually here, before we go down his list over here, so Berlin Max, as Manish has it written down, when you listen to this episode, could you send another email? I will reach out to you. I've got a couple of questions that I just want to ask you just regarding Germany, and I just want to clear it up. So Berlin Max, when you have a chance, there's a couple of tax laws that I want to sort of get better understanding of in Berlin.
Okay, nice. Okay, do you want to... So his next few questions are about Europe. And Abby, I know you spent a little bit of time in Europe back in the day on this side. Do you want to go through these?
Yeah, for sure. And it was actually in Berlin that I sort of got interested into Europe for. And I have a couple big funds that I work with out of Berlin. And we always chat about Europe. And Europe had this really rosy picture painted of all this upside growth potential, 760 million people for a total, like an insane total addressable market. But every time I talk to anybody from Germany, they always tell me this. They say, look, Germans are very slow to move. Okay. They say, you think Canadians are slow? Wait till you meet Germans. And it's hilarious because I always think I'm like, oh, like, you know, Germany's super sophisticated, whatever. Like they know everything. And everyone that I talk to, they're like, no, they don't. And when I started looking more and more into the EU market, it was like, it was abysmal. Like it wasn't even worth taking a look at.
Right.
Right. All these numbers that were sort of painted, they were skewed, right? Germany has not delivered to what they should have, to what they should have been. And I can't remember the exact sales number that they had, but it was like less than the worst performing US state.
Yeah, I think it was, and I'm butchering this a little bit, but I think the last stat I looked at, which was probably last year, was something like 200 million for the year in Germany. And the story was spun like Germany increases 50% from like 120 million to 100 and, you know, like to 200 million essentially, right?
Yeah, and the prescription count in Germany is only 320,000 people. I just pulled up my notes right now from my last call. Mm-hmm. It's only 320,000 people as of this year.
So it's not too bad if you look at it like, you know, 600 ahead or something, right? And like that's maybe that's euros. So, but like ultimately, if you look at what happened in Germany, like they had this local, they gave out these local licenses. They had to grow it to EU standards in like a bunker.
Yeah.
Right. And then the government was, had a contract to buy it off of like Aurora and Afria or whoever, at like 3 or 4 euros a gram.
Man, no, it was $9.50. That number has been quoted a lot. I know you and I, we've gone back and forth and trying to find out where that number's come from. That's a number that still gets thrown around in the industry. And there's a couple of research reports that do point at it now.
But I think that's what people are importing at. And again, I'm not an expert here, but the actual contract they signed for the local growers was much lower. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about it, you're like, okay, these guys have to grow it in these crazy like EU GMP bunkers. The flower is going to be terrible because they have to dry the crap out of it. And, you know, the medical patients are getting basically subpar flower but the companies are growing it crazy expensive and then selling it at like, you know, like not that great of a price mm-hmm. and in really low quantities. So like the EU strategy, when you look at it versus the US, it's like, why would we, like some of his questions here are like, would the MSOs ever buy into Canada to go to Europe? And it's like, why? Right? Like, Europe has to open significantly before it even gets as good as some of these US states.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the answers to these questions are like, hey, they're interesting topics, but it's not really worth digging into. Maybe someday somebody will make a lot of money here, but that day is not today and it's not tomorrow.
No, and there is increased interest in Europe, and that's because a lot of these companies are now able to list on the AIM exchange. So there was a little bit of a lift. But again, like Manish said, it's just not – there's lower-hanging fruit. So, Max, if you're looking, I would say in the States.
I would agree, but I'd say, look, Max, you have local expertise, so keep an eye on that. Like, keep your finger on the pulse. And, you know, maybe you can be first in the door when it does start to open up, right? But – right now, when I'm looking at it, I just don't see why the MSOs are making money hand over fist in these limited license markets.
Mm-hmm.
Why would they even care about Europe? Or, I mean, obviously Curaleaf did, right? But, you know, that's a small portion of their market cap, you know, like 3% of their market cap for a gargantuan company, right? And yeah, maybe they're thinking about the next 5 years or something, right? But ultimately, like, I don't see them looking at that market anytime soon. It's just way lower hanging fruit, to Abby's point. Okay, last point here from Max is, what's up with drinks in the US? Why are none of the big MSOs investing? You know, GTI is doing the deal with Cannes, but, you know, expected it to be more front and center. So we've actually talked about beverages for a while, and beverages are super, super exciting. They hold a lot of potential. I'm actually an investor in Cannes, so, you know, I love to see it getting out there. But it's still a tiny piece of the cannabis pie. And, you know, Cannes is doing really well. But let me just tell you that any company, not speaking about one in particular, if you have a niche product, it is really difficult to even do $10 million of sales. Like, super, super difficult if you're a novel product. Compare that to just opening a dispensary in Pennsylvania, for example. Mm-hmm. The average dispensary there does $6 or $7 million. So a good dispensary there can do $10 million quite comfortably. Like in Illinois, unless you don't fall over yourself, you're doing $10 million of sales with a dispensary license.
Oh wow!
Yeah, so that's just to show you that, like, you know, people get all excited about the qualitative, like, oh, this brand is going to change the world. Right. It's going to be amazing. But this is still the infrastructure phase.
Mm-hmm.
It comes to the low-hanging fruit. Like, maybe this brand and this product will change the world, but it's going to be a long, hard road to get there. Right. Whereas the easy money is still opening a limited license dispensary or grow or whatever. And not mm-hmm. to say that's super easy, but it's way easier than, you know, starting a novel product.
Right.
I mean, Abby, last point on that. How many pitches have we heard about, you know, the next XYZ product?
Oh, every single pitch. We're going to be the McDonald's of cannabis. We're going to be the Nike of cannabis. I've heard it all. Every single person I've met has been the best grower. Everybody has the best brand. And you know my theory. Like, I guess Cookies is now the only real brand. But I always mm-hmm. said there's no brands. There's only labels in the space. Mm-hmm. And Cookies is the only one that I think universally is accepted as a brand.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, and even then, it's pretty niche. Like, Cookies is super high-end flower.
Yeah.
Right? Like, So even then, you know, we all recognize it as a brand, but like, you know, the average Joe, you know, in Toronto or New York probably doesn't know what Cookies is.
That's very true. That is very true. It's only the cannabis people who actually like know what it is. And that goes back to the fact that we've been hearing this since 2017, 18, 19, 20, even I haven't heard it too much recently, but I'm sure if I was to go reach out to like a brand play, they would be like, oh, we're going to be the next big brand. And no, I don't think we're there yet. You know, in terms of where we are in the space, I don't think we're there to start investing in just brands. I think we got to do Manish, like what you said, look at, okay, what's a license worth? What can a license potentially generate? I think that's a better way to invest right now to sort of mitigate the volatility. But as the industry continues to evolve, our views are going to change and we're going to be like, okay, maybe XYZ brand, you know, they have achieved all of this. They have consistency. They've developed this lifestyle. They have great packaging and it's worked in, you know, mature markets, it's worked in nascent markets, it's worked in limited license states, it's worked in everywhere, right?
Yep. I mean, early days, right? I would keep an eye on Can. I think Can is going to do really well, and I think they're going to be a trailblazer, but it happens slowly. Like, it's going to happen quarter over quarter, right? As they open into new markets or in Illinois now, you know, they still need to be in more markets. Like, that's just that simple. Okay. Last two questions here. So we got to keep this rolling. Joe Yu, this is kind of interesting. Joe Yu sends us an email and he goes, hey, why do you guys say that these big MSOs aren't great investments? He's like, think about all the catalysts, SAFE, uplisting, 280E, you know, states legalizing. Like, shouldn't these companies go 2 to 3x over the next couple years? And what's interesting about this email is that Joe sent this on February 18th when things were getting pretty hot, right? So I don't know if Joe, you know, started listening then. I don't know if he's still listening, but you know, I just want to be clear here, and maybe we don't do a good enough job of explaining this. The biggest MSOs are good investments, but this comes to a capital allocation question, right? You only have so many dollars. And by the way, I just remembered what I was trying to say at the beginning of the podcast that I forgot. It's that what you said, Abby, that one of the biggest problems is we're not bringing new investors in right now.
Right.
And in that February wave, we did bring in a lot of new capital, right? We saw institutional capital jump into all these investments, you know, post the Senate flipping, right? And that was very exciting. And that's taken a bit of a breather and gone the other way with, you know, Credit Suisse is you know, forcing a bunch of people, you know, to not take custody of cannabis shares. And some of the other I don't know the verbiage, but I guess brokerages are doing the same in the US. So a little bit of a transition period here and people are a little spooked. But this doesn't have to do with us, by the way. It has to do with that Archegos hedge fund that blew up, I think. But all this is to say, you come down to this capital allocation question, which is also the last question that we have, which is, if you only have a dollar to put, where do you put it, right? And so you guys have heard me many times kind of, you know, say I don't love Curaleaf. Curaleaf is going to do fine over time. It might do great over time, but I only have this much money to put in. I have to put it in my highest conviction bets. So at the time when Joe wrote this email, you know, the Curaleafs and the GTIs and the Crescos were going through the roof and they were getting the most capital and the premiums. And so at that time, I took a step back from those companies because they were getting too much love. Okay. And that's great, but I can't pay that. You know, it's too rich for my blood. Right. I would rather go do what I did where I bought Bluma, which is a company nobody liked. And then, you know, I got lucky in that Cresco bought Bluma, which I never would have seen coming. But I thought it could have been anybody else who bought them. But Cresco bought it. So now I own Cresco shares at half the price.
Yeah. Right. And yeah. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh no, I was going to say regarding the big MSOs, Joe, you have to remember everyone's investment strategy is very different. So what Manish outlined there is really a high growth strategy. He's looking to get re-ratings where it's going to be growth, right? If his strategy was, okay, I want to mitigate my risk, which is what a lot of this institutional guys do, then, you know, Trulieve, Curaleaf, those might be better names. They have less downside than, let's say, Bluma, right? So you have to really remember what your why you're investing. And you know, like we said earlier, we love to roll in the pennies. We're high growth investors. So that's what we're going to gravitate more towards.
Yeah, and also, like, Abby and I both have, and we have different skill sets, but, like, we're not, like, we're, you know, we understand kind of what goes into these companies, right? We're willing to, like, crack open the financials. You know, in Abby's case, he's got a really good finger on the pulse of what makes some, you know, some of these stocks tick. So, you know, what that means, if you think about it, is, like, we're willing to maybe take some risks that newer investors, you know, shouldn't be taking. Right. So, and we've learned the hard way. This isn't our first year. This is our fourth or fifth year in this industry. Right. So that's why, you know, long answer is that I believe I can do kind of higher yielding deals, right? Like I did with Bluma. But I will say everything is dependent. So now with this pullback, I've been adding GTI like crazy because GTI has cooled off a lot. And, you know, you want to mix in your portfolio. You don't want everything to be value, value, value. Like I used to think that like, you know, value is the way to go, but really you want to mix because, you know, now my biggest positions will be, you know, GTI and Bluma. There'll be some of them. Or sorry, GTI and Cresco. And those are, you know, the quote unquote big four. And if tomorrow the sunshine comes back to our sector, GTI is going to be the first one to get the love, I think. Mm-hmm. Right. So I want to have some exposure to that momentum. And at this price, I like GTI, right? At 50% higher, I wasn't loving GTI when there was other options. So that's the thinking behind it. And it constantly changes. You know, if Cresco or GTI has a blowout quarter, I'll reevaluate.
That makes sense.
Okay, last question here. And it's very related, and it comes from a very well-educated listener who is Ben D. And Ben was actually asking, you know, if you had to start again from scratch, you clear the slate, start again today, do you focus on the big five names, or do you go for the more mid-tier or mid-cap MSOs? And then he mentions a couple of names like Parallel and AYR and Glasshouse and the parent company. And he goes, look, am I being too greedy looking here or should I just focus on the big five? And actually Nick, who's Can Investments, he answered. So I'll just give his answer quickly, which is that he would kind of mix them up and he would do like overweight on like a Columbia Care and AYR up to like 20%. You know, then he'd mix in some GTI and some Cresco and some Trulieve, like 10 to 15%, a little bit of Verano, and then maybe mix in some of those Parallel, Curaleaf, TerrAscend, Jushi, Next Green Wave, Vireo, that kind of stuff, right? So, you know, a pretty balanced diet, but, you know, you can see the meat and potatoes is really these kind of mid and large cap MSOs.
Yeah, and it's clearly all U.S. focused.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, good point, Abby. Yeah. So
there's no Colombia there. There's no Canada there. There's no Israel. There's no Europe. So yes, I would do it very different. Yeah. To answer your question.
Do you want to give a little bit of color? Do you want me to go?
No, you go. You go ahead.
Okay. So I would just say, look, Ben, it was an interesting question. I actually went and I constantly am updating my portfolio because the last couple of weeks when we have all of this volatility and movement, I'm making a ton of moves. Like I'm selling, I'm trimming this, I'm buying this, I'm going from here to here. I may be trying to put more money in. Like a lot of movements happen. And because I have a very good feel of these companies and the prices that I like them at, I can jump around pretty quickly, right? So I think I mentioned the other day that I sold a bunch of my SOL. You know, I did that because of where GTI was trading. Right. And I go, man, like GTI looks really attractive here. What should I do? Okay, let me sell SOL, which is actually still doing really well, and let me move it to GTI. So those are the kind of moves I can make pretty quickly. And what I would say is in one word, I go for barbell. So the mistake I made, you know, when I started my portfolio from scratch last year, because I sold everything, was I went too much on the value side, right? Mm-hmm. So only going for like the Liberty Health of the world. You want to mix because when big money shows up, when the love comes in, it's going to go to GTI and Curaleaf and Cresco and blah, blah, blah. Right. So, you know, it's really a mix. So if I had to break it down, I would say like 30% is kind of like GTI, Cresco, maybe a little bit of Verano, maybe a little bit of Trulieve, you know, that kind of shining top tier, right? Then that mid-tier is probably like another 40%. So Ascend Wellness, which is coming out soon, Pharmacan, AYR, Columbia Care, those make up kind of that middle layer, like pretty much top tier operators, but just not recognized that way yet, right? So pretty heavy on those guys. And then another 30% is like, you know, I've recently put on Harvest, Vireo, Parallel. These are MSOs that people don't really know or understand or love. Harvest, by the way, my theory is they're going to have a huge Q1 and probably a really good Q2 because of Arizona. So, you know, these are kind of more value picks that people don't love as much. And then in that 30% is, you know, kind of the Manish special, you know, like that crappy, weird penny stock, you know, the consortium of the world that nobody likes. Try to buy those early on when people aren't paying attention and, you know, riding those to a certain point and getting out of those, right? So there's enough of a mix there that there's a bunch of stuff you're not really selling, and there's a bunch of stuff that you might trade in and out. And it gives you a little flavor of everything. And that, but again, to Abby's point, all very much US focused, all very MSO or SSO focused. You know, really kind of, you know, I have a good understanding of what I like, but then within that sandbox, I'm willing to be, you know, willing to play around a little bit.
For sure. And Ben, to my answer will be short and sweet here, especially in the cannabis side. I wouldn't really focus on the big fives. I would only buy the big five if some sort of event happened, that sort of a non-material event that occurred that brought their price down. GTI is a great example. That Chicago Tribune article that came out, I actually started picking some up there. That was probably my only exposure to GTI since like mid-2019. I would focus more on AYR. I would focus more on, actually, Columbia Care I do like. That's because they, again, Manish, you're the one who put me onto that one in terms of an infrastructure play. So I would like that. And then I would look for, I wouldn't look at companies. I would look for new states that are coming online, limited license states. And then I would look for companies that are trying to enter those states, because I think they'll get a re-rating as more people want exposure to those states.
And that, you know, to think of those kind of three buckets, you know, that top tier, that mid tier, and that, that sort of bottom quote unquote tier, you know, there's probably more than three. I mean, at some point we got to figure out a better way of classifying these companies, because like, they don't really all like these classifications are not the best. Like there really is different, more tiers than this. And you know, like some of these really small single state operators, it's weird to put them in the same bucket as like a Harvest. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, but you know, Abby's point, which is a good one, which is that, you know, some of these small names can have the best returns, because if you buy something that has a good business that nobody's looking at, it can get a lot of love upwards once people catch on to it. Right. But again, you want to be a little bit careful, because so much of this industry in terms of stock movement is event driven, that or, you know, just catalyst driven. You never know, you know, when people are going to wake up and love GTI, or when they're going to wake up and decide that, you know, AYR is the next big five company.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And again, with AYR, I mean, like, the reason I like it so much is because the biggest risk is execution risk. And I look at that company and say, okay, during the pandemic, they only had exposure to Massachusetts and Las Vegas.
Yep.
Nevada. And in Massachusetts, cannabis was deemed unessential,
yep,
or not essential. And in Vegas or in Nevada, you have Vegas.
It was dead.
Right. It was dead.
It was dead. Yeah.
And they blew it. They had a blowout quarter. They like killed it. And so just showed the management's ability to execute. And so when you know they're going on this M&A spree, people are like, oh well, execution risk is there. I mute that down and I say, hey, listen, I don't think that risk is as glaring or as high as you guys, everybody's quantifying in their models. And that's why I like the company.
Yeah, that's a great point. And you know, AYR is a name I need to add some more to. It's definitely in a good spot.
Just do it after I buy.
Abby, any final thoughts for, you know, investing through bad times and kind of, you know, watching history repeat itself?
Oh man, there's tons of thoughts that I can say, but you know, for to wrap it up, I would say really know what you own, right? Like when things start going down, it's very important to know the names that you own. And you know what, do not be afraid of taking losses or crystallizing losses on names that you don't know. Right, they could come back, they could rebound, but it's more important now to know what you own and why you own it. And then when these things do happen, you have a better understanding of what's going on.
That's a great point. I like that. I guess I would say learn from this experience, right? I mean, this pullback is not that bad of a pullback. I know it hurts a lot. And I want to share with you guys, like, you know, obviously, you know, you guys can hear, I'm very confident when I say, look, I'm buying the dip, but it's still scary, right? Like, even when I'm buying, I'm like, you know, oh my God, is this going to go 20% lower, you know, or even just should I wait and buy this, you know, cheaper tomorrow, right? If it's possible. Mm-hmm. And you never know where the maximum pain point is. And by the way, we might not be done. I mean, we've had a pullback, right? And yet the broader market is still very buoyant. So if that pulls back, like, who knows where we'll end up, right?
Yeah.
But value, like, it is what it is. I know today it doesn't feel like the sun is shining on us, but ultimately you have to ask yourself what has changed. And if all that has changed is that, you mm-hmm. know, the MSO gang is not as excited as they were before, right? I mean, I like that. I don't like when all these people show up pounding the table, you know, telling us why we should be buying, you know, their new, you know, their favorite MSO, right? I mean, it's, mm-hmm. it really is when the heat goes away a little bit, like what we're seeing, that is a good time to be an investor.
Yeah.
And last point is, I can't remember who it was. I think it was Mike. I can't remember who it was. Somebody said to us, hey, it's pulled back now. So maybe these companies can't go 3 to 5x anymore, but they can still do okay.
Yeah.
And it's exactly, that is exactly the thinking that should be reversed. When the companies pull back, you have a better chance of going 3 to 5x.
Oh yeah, for sure. For right. Sure. As long as it's mm-hmm. okay, hold on. When the companies mm-hmm. pull back, as long as it's like a non-material event that nothing's really changed and the price is just down.
Yeah. When things are going hyperbolic, everybody thinks they can keep going hyperbolic forever.
Yeah.
Right. But to Abby's mm-hmm. point, if the fundamentals haven't changed, it's just hype coming out of the market, which this is what we're living right now. Right. That's what we're living in. When the price comes down and comes down by 35%, you know, you just greatly increased your chance of hitting a 3 to 5 bagger.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's a good thing, but it doesn't always feel that way. And so that's the hard part.
Yeah.
All right, guys, cinpodcast@gmail.com. We will do another Q&A sometime in the future. Until next time.
This podcast is a general communication and entertainment being provided for informational purposes only. It is educational in nature and not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment product, strategy, plan, feature, or other purposes. Any examples used in this podcast are generic, hypothetical, and for entertainment purposes only. None of Cannabis Investing Network or its affiliates are suggesting that the listener or any other person take a specific course of action or any action at all. Communications such as this are not impartial and are provided in connection with advertising and marketing of products and services. Prior to making any investment or financial decisions, an investor should seek individualized advice from a personal financial, legal, tax, and other professional advisor that take into account all of the particular facts and circumstances for an investor's own situation. By listening to this communication, you agree with the intended purpose described earlier. Opinions and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions constitute our judgment and are subject to change without notice. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors.